the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, one of the pressing issues out there in the culture has to do with animals, animal rights, the status of animals, how we should treat animals, and all the rest. Some of this came up just in recent days because there have been so many issues about, for instance, the wildlife being destroyed due to the oil spill in the Gulf, where you have a collision in other cases between human and animal priorities. And, you know, on this program, I get a remarkable number of questions about how we should think about pets. So we're going to get to it. And it's going to be open microphone. We're going to be talking about animals. Let's talk about how Christians should understand animals, pets, out in nature, wherever. And, of course, this reaches down to questions of whether we should eat them and wear their skins and enjoy their companionship and lock them up in cages and look at them in zoos and put hooks in the water and catch them and eat them. You know, fascinating questions. Let's get to it. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and this is a very serious question. And it may be that in this generation, more than in any other, in this particular cultural moment, we're asking this question with a new velocity and with a new sense of urgency. And we'll get to that in just a moment. Again, write us at mail@albertmohler.com, at Facebook / that is the Albert Mohler Program, at Twitter / Albert Mohler and Mohler Radio. And, of course, we give priorities to calls, 877-893-TALK. At my website at albertmohler.com, I posted an article today that I think is really important, and I would just urge you to get this article and read this article and read the article in the Atlantic Monthly that is behind my article. I'm writing an article entitled The End of Men, A Hard Look at the Future. Hannah Rosen, a writer that I've cited several times on this program, someone who has a tremendous amount of insight that she brings to the major pieces of journalism she produces. She has a cover story in this issue of The Atlantic. That's the July-August 2010 issue of The Atlantic. The cover story, The End of Men, How Women Are Taking Control of Everything. And, folks, this is simply huge. It is a huge piece of documentation that she has produced here, writing about the shift from men to women in Western civilization and why it matters. She argues that men are simply falling behind women in almost every sector of cultural influence and economic power. She recognizes that this is unprecedented in the span of human history. She writes, as she begins her article, the fact that sex selection technologies in the West are now more often used to select a preference for girls than for boys. Now, that reverses something that was a real fear even 20 years ago, that these sex selection technologies in the West would lead to a preference for boys. Well, it may have started out that way, but it didn't end up that way. And she's asking, what does that tell us? Now, just a footnote there. Elsewhere in the world, it's still very much a preference for boys, which leads to the phenomenon of missing females in much of the developing world. But right now, what she's writing about is what's going on in the United States in particular. The global recession has been largely a he-cession. 3 out of 4 jobs lost were lost in male-dominated places of work. 8 million jobs lost. 3/4 of them were in areas, she says, overwhelmingly male and deeply identified with macho, construction, manufacturing, high finance. She acknowledges some of these jobs will come back, but the overall pattern of dislocation is neither temporary nor random. In the United States, for the first time in the nation's history, women now outnumber men in the workforce, the working class, which has long defined our notions of masculinity, Rosen explains, is slowly turning into a matriarchy, with men increasingly absent from the home and women making all the decisions. She points out the post-industrial economy is indifferent to men's size and strength. The attributes that are most valuable today are social intelligence, open communication, the ability to sit still and focus. She says at a minimum, these are not predominantly male. She makes 2 main points, and both demand attention. The first has to do with what's going on in working-class families, and there she describes the matriarchy that is developing. You know, one of the things she points out is that you've got women who are now setting standards for the kind of man they will marry, and their standards are higher than the available men, so they're not getting married, and men are simply not a part of their equation. She describes men as casualties of the end of manufacturing era. And that's huge because you've got older men who lost their jobs and the jobs aren't coming back. And then you got younger men who, for the first time in the nation's history, really face no prospect of getting a job that is going to carry them through their adult lives. Certainly in terms of the American expectation in the 20th century, and that is now gone. Of the 15 job classifications marked for future growth, men dominate only in two. Those two are janitorial services and computer engineering. Women, in terms of managerial and professional roles, hold 51.4% of jobs. Rosen explains that women make up 54% of all accountants, hold about half of all banking and insurance jobs. About a third of America's doctors are now women, as are 45% of associates in law firms. Beyond the numbers, she reports that the office environments and corporate cultures are adopting to women as well. It's becoming a far more feminized society. And yet, her second argument is even more important. When she looks not at the current workforce, but what's happening on America's college and university campuses, and there it's just overwhelmingly female. And what that means, folks, is that this pattern of men falling behind, of boys falling behind, is now becoming institutionalized, because the bachelor's degree, the baccalaureate, is basically the entry card into middle class expectation. And without that, the kinds of jobs that men used to be able to get that used to keep them financially solvent in terms of their lifestyle and enable them to support a family, that they're just not there. And that is a huge problem. Boys are falling behind girls in educational achievement and educational aspiration. 60% of all baccalaureate degrees in the United States are granted to women rather than to men. And it's really, really interesting. You look at this, boys, quote, are just failing to adapt. Women now earn 60% of master's degrees, and about half of all law and medical degrees, 42% of all MBAs. The failure of boys to strive for educational attainment is a sign of looming disaster. I don't think there's any question about that. And even as it's a sign of looming disaster, it's also a reminder to us that as a rule, and anyone who works with youth and young adults is seeing this, boys are just not growing up as girls, not as fast as girls. They are falling way behind. And because of that, we've got a big challenge. Now, what does it mean for large sectors of our society to become virtual matriarchies? How do we prepare the church to deal with such a world while maintaining biblical models of manhood and womanhood? Well, it's interesting you have this cover story in Atlantic Monthly. It tells us that the elites are awakening to the fact that these vast changes point to a very different future. Christians had better know that what matters far more than matters of economics are the matters of the soul and the matters of life and the matters of marriage. Now, Christians had better know that these trends represent nothing less than the collapse of male responsibility, leadership, and expectations. And here is my bottom line argument, folks. The real issue here is not the end of men, but the disappearance of manhood. Well, I would encourage you to find that article. I would encourage you to go to Hannah Rosen's piece behind that article. And as you have a chance to look at it, you'll come to understand something of what's going on. And I think we're going to have to be looking at this more and more, recognizing that it represents a huge shift that isn't going to go away. It's not a snapshot of America in the year 2010, something that's going to go away and be replaced by, you know, returning to previous patterns. Those previous patterns are gone. And we are sowing the seeds for a tremendous challenge to young men to be able to be the kind of men that God would have them to be, to provide for their families, to lead. And folks, as a parent, as a pastor, whatever role you have to look at this and say, we are failing somehow to get our boys ready for manhood, to get them ready for the very real challenges of a post-industrial civilization. We're having a real issue here, getting them ready for real life and real responsibility. And that's something that's going to take a lot of us a lot of time to figure out. And it's going to be a huge challenge to the church, not only in the next months, but for years to come. You know, the data coming in from a lot of these studies is simply beyond our imagination. Business Week, now called Bloomberg Business Week after the merger, has a fascinating little factoid window. It turns out that Goldman Sachs was subpoenaed by the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. The commission demanded information. and Goldman Sachs gave them information. It's now being claimed by the commission that they were basically assaulted with a vast amount of information, 5 terabytes. That's 2.5 billion pages. And Business Week tried to make that tangible. It would take 159 years to print it out on a laser printer. It would cover 28,700 football fields. It would fill 625 8-gigabyte flash drives. It would weigh 12,500 tons, equivalent to 1,650 male elephants, and it would equal the entire Twitter archive. You know, it tells us something, that this kind of data is accessible, ready to be downloaded from just one corporation answering just one question. We are drowning in data. Folks, are we drowning in wisdom? We're going to come back to talk about how we think about animals and treat animals, how Christians should think about the whole question on the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number, 877-893-8255. We'll be right back with your calls on the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. How should we think about animals? You know, that is a fascinating question, and it's a fairly new question. I mean, it's not new as if Christians have never faced the question before, but it's rather new in terms of the urgency with which it's being posed to us. We have animal rights activists. We have people who are just absolutely pet-centric. And then we have other folks who say there's no responsibility whatsoever. They're just animals. Just animals. Let's think about that. There are several principles we want to nail down and start thinking about. But first, we're going to go to a call. Elizabeth's calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Let's on WFIA. What are you thinking, Elizabeth?
Well, I'm thinking that I know that, you know, even according to Scripture, we're told to be kind to animals. And I also know that we've been given animals that we can have for food. But I think in our society, I think we've gone overboard. I mean, you have people that stuff their pets once they die. And, you know, you have animal rights activists that will get out there and fight for animal rights, but we have people that are living homeless on the streets that, you know, people wouldn't even give, you know, any thought about. So it makes me wonder, you know, it makes me look at it like we put animals above human rights.
Yeah, you know, what's really, really interesting is, Elizabeth, that we seem to have a kind of, polarity going on here, where on the one hand, you have people who celebrate animals so much, it's clear that they do not understand the basic distinction between animals and human beings. Now, I have to say, on the other hand, there are other folks, I think, who fail to understand God's delight in his own creatures and the responsibility that comes with having dominion over them. Let's just go to Genesis 1 for a moment. In Genesis 1, the Lord spoke to Adam and Eve, the man and the woman whom he had made, and he said, "Behold, I've given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed. It shall be food to you." He said, "To every beast of the earth and every bird of the sky and everything that moves on the earth which has life, I've given every green plant for food." And it was so. Just before that, we are told God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Now, the reason I read it in that order is because, you know, the dominion we have over plants and vegetation and given to us for food, that's really not very controversial. It really isn't. Now, I can't say it's absolutely non-controversial, because I actually appeared on the Larry King Live program one time with another guest who off camera made the statement that when she saw a wheat thresher going through a wheat field, she could hear the screams of the wheat. Okay, I don't know what to do with a person who hears screaming wheat, but I will tell you this. Most people don't find that controversial, that we're given plants for food. But animals, in terms of the dominion over animals, in terms of the responsibility to rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and everything that moves upon the earth, that's said in Genesis 1, in verse 28, before you even get to the vegetation. And what is very clear, the biblical worldview is premised upon the fact that human beings are the special creation of God. Human beings are the creature made God's image. And as the creature made God's image, we are distinct from every other creature. Now, a part of what the image of God means, and it means more than we could possibly understand, given our finitude, more than we could possibly understand given our sinfulness, and more than we could possibly talk about in the confines of this program, let's just say it means at least this, that we are the only creatures made able to consciously know and worship God. We are the only creatures who have the ability to know the Creator, to worship the Creator, and to obey or to disobey the Creator. And that sets us apart from all the other animals. And thus, it is homicide to kill a human being, which is literally the destruction of the image of God. But it is not the same thing when we, for instance, kill an animal for food. It's not the same thing when we say to an animal, you stay outside, we're going inside. It is not an image confusion there. We understand that human beings alone are made the image of God. Now, the other interesting thing that goes on here is, nonetheless, that God takes delight in these creatures. Once he created them, he declared them to be good. And it is clear that the Creator's delight is in the diversity and the wonder and the beauty and the intelligence and the cuteness and just the marvels and wonders of the animal kingdom. But there's a clear distinction here. And what do we do with that? Then, you know, that at least settles the issue. By the time you come to Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 and Genesis 3, it's very clear that we are to eat the animals. It's very clear that they are given to us so that we can wear their skins and enjoy even the experience of eating them. But there is no sense in which the Scripture would validate in any way the misuse of the stewardship. Dominion entails stewardship. And it is our responsibility to look to the animals with the kind of stewardship that God would expect of those who are made his image. And that means that we would use them for all the purposes for which he gave them to us, for our enjoyment, for our food, for our clothing and shoes. But we would never mistreat them. We must never despise them. And we must recognize they have a proper place in this kingdom that God has made, the cosmos himself, as well. And they will, by the way, in the age to come. There's no reason to expect that in the new heaven and the new earth there will not be animals. As a matter of fact, we are pointed to the reality that the lion and the lamb will lie together. And that is a very important reminder to us that the fullness of creation and more is going to be in the new heaven and the new earth. Not less, but more. But right now, we live in a Genesis 3 world, and in that Genesis 3 world, there are animals who can do awful things to us. Just a few days ago, a grizzly bear killed an elderly hiker. And you look at that and you say, wow, that is just horrifying. You have an encounter with a great white shark, you'll probably lose. Venomous snakes have venom. Dogs bite. But at the same time, there is a delight in these creatures, and in so many of them, especially what we have in terms of animals that are appropriately pets or companion animals. But then again, you look at pets, you know, how quickly can that get out of scale? How quickly can that get out of proportion? What does it mean, as we've talked about on this program, that you have restaurants in some areas that are now allowing the seating of pets because people are treating them as their children, expecting them to be treated and considered as their children, welcomed into homes and restaurants and places of business? You're living in an odd world. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's try to dispel some of the confusion and get a clear view of how Christians biblically should think about animals. I'd love to have you join the discussion. We have people writing in on Facebook. Julie writes in, with respect, you have people who are saying they are pet parents, and she says that definitely crosses the line these days. Oh, I think so. I know very clearly you got these people who see no difference between pets and children. And, you know, folks, that's a category error that insults the image of God and the glory of God. And it also leads to catastrophic ethical bad decisions. And when you start looking at how some people treat their animals, the Wall Street Journal, again, cover story in terms of the bottom of the page just a few days ago, on a chihuahua, that's right, a chihuahua, the little Mexican dog, perhaps best known for doing Taco Bell commercials. One of these little dogs has inherited a vast multi-million dollar estate. Lorena Hemsley, you may remember, also left a good deal of money to a dog. Meanwhile, as Elizabeth said when she called, there are people starving to death. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Let's go to Tampa, Florida. Kyle's listening on WTBN. Go ahead, Kyle. Kyle, you there? All right, well, we went to Colin, lost him. Let's go to Brian calling from Louisville, Kentucky. This is on WFIA. What are you thinking, Brian?
Hey, Dr. Mueller. I wondered if you could speak to this issue. I've talked to many people who are vegetarian because they are evolutionists. They believe that we come from the same place that animals do. And when I've talked to them, I've tried to speak to the huge inconsistency that if we come from the same place that animals do, then so do vegetables and fruit and plants as well. Also, many of them do not think that animals should not eat one another. They're completely fine with animals, technically, in their terms, murdering one another out in the wild. Didn't know if you could speak to that inconsistency for me.
Yeah, you know, Brian, inconsistency is a sign of a need to rethink an issue. And that can happen to ourselves. We can all of a sudden have brought to our own attention where there's an inconsistency that would betray the need for us to think more deeply and more carefully. You know, one of the tests of a worldview, Brian, is whether you can extend it to its logical conclusion. That is one of the proofs I would offer to you of the Christian gospel. It is a worldview that can be extended to its logical conclusion without inconsistency. The vegan or vegetarian worldview is one that's very difficult to extend to its logical conclusion in terms of trying to figure out why that's there. Now, if it's just a personal preference, well, then you're just establishing personal preference. If you're claiming it's a matter of principle, then you have a deeper problem. Because if you're talking about respect for life, you know, Brian, you're making the right point. You know, vegetation is life. And you're also making the point that if you are going to commit yourself to an evolutionary understanding and an evolutionary worldview, you can't have animal life without preceding vegetation and non-conscious, non-animal life. And so you look at that and you realize that if this is supposedly about respect for life, you're only making a very arbitrary judgment to say it starts with this. And you'll also notice that most of these people will swat insects. And by the way, if you are unwilling to swat an insect, you're going to be inviting death. Because many of the plagues in human history have been carried about by mosquitoes and other insects. And also, jumping to the next category, by rodents. And so it's not just about whether you would eat them. It's about whether it's right or wrong to kill animals under any circumstance or to kill life. And, again, harvesting a wheat field, I'll never forget hearing that woman say she could hear the screams. Well, you know, if you're committed to that kind of pantheistic worldview, I guess you're going to hear a lot of things scream. Cabbages, asparagus, strawberries, you name it. Thanks so much for your call. You know, when you start thinking about this, you realize that we've got a huge problem. It just in terms of thinking these things through, because it's hard to even have an intelligent and honest conversation about it. Let's go to Rushton, Louisiana. Listen to XM Radio. It's Kim. What are you thinking, Kim?
Well, I just like to make the comment, you know, first of all, I'm an animal lover, but they make advertisements about mistreatment of animals, which I'm all for, not for, you know, mistreatment of animals, but if you were to make an ad about a mistreatment of an unborn life concerning abortion, it wouldn't even be allowed to play on TV. And you have people that are being put in jail and that are being prosecuted for mistreatment of animals, which that's all fine and good. But what about mistreatment of human life?
Yeah. Very good point, Kim, and especially unborn human life. That's where you're on especially strong ground there. And, for instance, you've got some of the same people arguing for a woman's right to an abortion and making it a federal crime to even touch a bald eagle egg. or to get near its nest, and multiple tens of thousands of dollars in fines and criminal sanctions for someone that would, for instance, disturb turtle eggs on the beach. So what you're looking at here is a vast disconnect, and it goes back to the fact, as we began this conversation, that the scripture says there's a clear distinction, not in terms of the origins of all life. That's attributable to the creative act of a sovereign, omnipotent creator alone, but rather to the fact that there is some life. Indeed, there is one form of life that is made God's image, able consciously to know him. And thus it has a different, you know, theologians have to use big words. It's called a different ontological status. That means its being is of a completely different kind. It's not like there's a scale of being and you have animals and then you kind of, in an evolutionary scheme, get up to human beings. No, human beings are different. They are objectively different because we alone are made God's image. Now, that also means that, as Scripture says, we've been given a stewardship of dominion and a dominion of stewardship. And that means we cannot despise what God celebrates, but it also means we are to rightly use what he gives us. So that is the real question. How do we find that balance in a world of such confusion? The phone number is 877-893-8255. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're talking about how Christians should think about animals. I'll tell you what I think the hardest question is, and this hasn't really come up yet, but I'll tell you, I think the hardest question comes down to what's called factory farming. I think my theological and moral reasoning is most stretched when posed with many of the realities of mass animal production for meat and food and various other uses. I do not have a settled answer as to what is absolutely right or wrong there. And I think it would take a great deal of investigation and many people who are looking into it. But the reality is that it seems that many of the people who most openly condemn this kind of farming actually don't have much of an answer how it could be fixed in order to keep people fed. So those are the issues in which I think there ought to be a lot of ongoing conversation. We need not to let that issue drop. Let's go to Sanford calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, Sanford.
Well, Dr. Mueller, my question is, the Seventh-day Adventists, they propose or are biblically driven to not eat animals, and that's just confusing to me that, you know, in the Christian faith that there's two different messages, both coming from the Bible. I was wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, I'll tell you, Sanford, you really can't find a clear mandate for vegetarianism in the Bible. I'll make that just as boldly as I just said it. There is no biblical text. There is no biblical teaching. To the contrary, you even have, in the New Testament, the opening of animal meat that had been considered unclean to be clean. And, you know, in terms of the vision that was given there to Peter at the Tanner's house, it's a very clear understanding of the fact that animals, and by the way, that was a Tanner's house, which was using skins, something that was not kosher, but in terms of the process, but was certainly allowable in terms of wearing. And so when you look at that, Seventh-day Adventism is one of the issues, and that's why it came up. It was Ask Anything Wednesday a week ago that came up. And it is because at least the foundations of that movement include some legalism based upon the insights claimed by Ellen White that have to do with things that go far beyond Scripture. And for that reason, there are bigger theological issues than animals, but that is right at the center of it. So, Sanford, I just got to tell you, that's why there isn't a mainstream Christian church that preaches any mandate for vegetarianism. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Stephen calling from Orlando, Florida, listening on WTLN. Go ahead, Stephen.
Hey, Dr. Mueller. I was curious. You may have answered the question a moment ago, but I'd like to open it up, I guess, for discussion for other people. But I was kind of wondering, at what point do we consider animals to be abused? Because, I eat meat. And I know that animals are given to us to eat for food, and but then, like you mentioned, with the mass production of food and animals and stuff like that, and the things that happen with mass production, kind of cutting corners and the abuse that can go on, and hormone injections and all that stuff. At what point could we consider, like, removing ourselves from that system like that? Because
Yeah, Stephen, we're losing your signal, but we're sure getting your point. That's a very intelligent question, and that's one that I expected would come up. I acknowledge, as you said, that when it comes to these so-called factory farms, this is where we're stretched in terms of our ability to render a really satisfactory moral judgment here. And I can tell you what I think some of the issues are. Issue number one, we tend to anthropomorphize animals. So we tend to think that this would not be appropriate for an animal, sometimes measured in more emotional and intuitionist ways that aren't really good ethical reasoning. Second thing is, the assumption made by some animal rights activists, in fact, they're not an assumption, but the claim is that animals were meant to be free, so any constraint upon them that is unlike what they would be like in nature is wrong. In other words, the whole idea of a domestic animal is a problem for some of the animal rights movement. They wouldn't be happy with any kind of domestication of animals, much less for food. I will tell you this. On the other hand, I think Stephen, when you look at this, you recognize there are clearly situations in which the animal is being almost casually, callously mistreated, in which there could be pain and harm done to an animal that could be avoided. And I guess that's the calculus. That's where I have to say we have a mandate and a need to feed and clothe a massive numbers of human beings made God's image. And then we also have the reality that even as God has given us these animals, in the same way that he's given us the planet, we must respect this this gift as we exercise dominion and stewardship. And that respect means we will not despitefully treat anything God has made for his own glory. And as much as it would be sin to desecrate the landscape just for the purpose of doing so, in other words, just because we want to make harm befall something, just even despitefully treating a tree. I mean, in cutting down a tree for shelter, cutting down a tree for some good human end, there's no conscience issue in that. But cutting down a tree simply because you have some malevolence towards the tree or you're just trying to desecrate the tree, that would hardly be something to be morally justifiable. Well, of how much more importance then would, a cow be than a tree? Because the cow, unlike the tree, would be conscious of its own mistreatment. And that's where animals are often presented to us. You know, we revert to them. You often see this in English, especially in older literature, as dumb animals. In other words, they have enough consciousness of the fact that they might suffer and they can experience real suffering. But at the same time, we don't recognize the animals, and we should not, as having the kind of consciousness the human beings have. So this is where I have to say, Stephen, it's really tough. It's really tough. And that's where I want to say to animal rights activists, look, if you've got a better way to do this, then bring it to the table. And I think that would be the appropriate response of industry. You've got a better way to do this, then bring it to the table. If it's something that we can accomplish that would actually lead to better human flourishing as well, then that's something we really need to look at. We need to take responsibility. And yet, you know, some of the things that are being proposed would make meat unaffordable, unavailable, and that's the real agenda of some people. And so, you know, this is where I think there needs to be an ongoing Christian conversation. We're not going to settle this and tie it up with a bow today as if when it comes to a matter like factory farming, we know exactly the right position. I think it's a good thing this has been put on the agenda. It's a good thing it's on our consciousness. It's a good thing the question has been posed. I think it has often been posed by those who have an agenda other than the question itself. But that doesn't mean the question doesn't have to be answered. It doesn't mean that we do not now have a responsibility to deal with it. And I think you're going to see some very fruitful Christian consideration coming forward. I think you've got a younger generation of theologians and Christian thinkers coming along who are going to say, you know, we're going to have to look at this. We're going to have to think it through clearly, and we're going to have to try our best to come to a good, honest, straightforward, biblical understanding, and then, as I say, let the chips fall where they may. Back with more. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Fascinating discussion, and one that more easily is started than finished, because we're talking about, in the most difficult questions, an area that the Christian Church has given inadequate thought. And that's a good wake-up call here in the beginning of the 21st century. We're going to have to think about this more clearly. because there are cultural and social forces pressing these questions on us, and we're going to have to come up with a better answer than we don't know. So let's just talk about what the big questions are. Is it right and allowable for us to look to animals as a source of food and clothing and other goods? The answer to that is yes, absolutely. The scripture authorizes that explicitly. Okay. Now, at the next stage, is it right to understand that we are properly attracted to animals in terms of our joy in seeing them, our delight in watching them, even our development of certain kinds of relationships with them, of friendship and camaraderie and companionship? Well, yes, there would be a biblical allowance for that, too. But can these things very quickly get out of priority? Yes. And that's where there has to be a clear distinction between humanity made God's image and the animal kingdom as reflecting the glory of God, but unconsciously so. The animal reflects the glory of God, but human beings may worship. That's a very different thing. And human beings either obey or disobey God. And the animals, nonetheless, merely do what instinct and opportunity drive and allow them to do. And you start looking at that, you realize there are huge differences here. I've admitted to you, I think the most difficult issue is the factory farming question. I think that's where our mandate and responsibility to keep people fed and to keep food affordable and available runs into a conflict with whether there is avoidable human suffering, that is animal suffering, avoidable animal suffering that's taking place in that context. And that's where it's going to take a lot of further thinking. That's where someone's going to have to look closely at this, as folks now are, and come up with a better way of understanding the question rather than just shouting about it in terms of public debate. We're going to have to take a good, honest, thorough look at this. Are things out of proportion? You bet. When we are spending more on pet food than would keep some impoverished nations alive, then yes, we've got a problem. When we have some people looking to their pets as if they are their children and investing them with the kind of attention and goods and wealth that is just insanely directed towards the animals, then yes, we've got a problem. But on the other extreme, we've got a problem with some Christians who think that it is beneath our moral responsibility and dignity to have to consider the good of other creatures as well. That, too, is our responsibility. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. We'll be Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Miller Program. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.